welcome to the Picture House podcast, our late September, going into October edition of the show. Today, I am joined by Toby King from Picture House Entertainment.
Hi.
And Karina Andrevis from Picture House Cinemas / Picture House Entertainment.
Picture House Everything.
Picture House Everything. And I'm Sam Clements, your host for the Picture House podcast. There's a whole load of films out, which is very exciting. We're going to talk about films for the next couple of weeks, which I think is good. We're into like quite a rich period of cinema going.
Yes, at last.
I actually don't really want to be here with you guys. I really want to be in the cinema watching some movies.
We wrap this up, we can go.
This is true. But we're going to talk about some really exciting films, which I'm really pleased about. Before we do that, Toby, you're a new guest on the Picture House podcast.
I am.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about you, your history at Picture House?
Yeah, my name's Toby King. I've been with Picture House for many years, many moons. I was on the podcast years and years ago with you, if you remember, when we did an event in Brighton. We did a 90s action movie all-nighter.
Oh, yeah, that
about
was really
five
awesome.
Or 6 years ago at the Duke of York's. I think I was on the podcast then to talk about our love of 90s action movies. And it's taken about 6 years for me to come back on. So
every 6 years.
It's great to be here.
The door is
shows
welcome.
How good you were back then.
Yeah. It was so good. You had to wait 6 years to bring me back.
You needed a breather.
It's great to be here. And since then, I've been involved with Picture House Central, getting that mothership up and running. And now I work at Picture House Entertainment in the distribution realm.
Nice. And Karina, returning guest, you have just come back from the Toronto Film Festival. And I mean, I don't want to sound jealous or anything, but Toby and I did get some serious FOMO looking at your Instagrams. Highlight of the Toronto Film Festival?
Oh, I mean, just being there is just awesome. I mean, being at a film festival is my happy place. But I managed to watch, I think, 19, maybe 20 films over my 5 days there. I saw the much anticipated If Beale Street Could Talk, which is Barry Jenkins' new film. I saw First Man, which was very good, and it's coming out soon, which was very good. Also saw some real good British films, including Wild Rose, which is an excellent film directed by Tom Harper and stars Jesse Buckley, who was in Beast.
Yes, and the Cineworld advert, if you watch their Unlimited commercials.
I did not know that. But it turns out she's a fantastic, fantastic singer, and she plays this working class hero, fresh out of jail, young mum, and she's following her dreams to become a country singer. Not a country and western singer, a country singer. And it was so good and full of heart, so that's one to watch out for. Also loved Maya Hansen Love's new film, Maya, and Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is the Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant new film, which is coming out soon. And also some real art house gems. So Rafiki, which is also known as Friend in Kenyan, was a really beautiful lesbian love story. Such an interesting trajectory of trying to get out there in the big world anyway because of the Kenyan laws against same-sex relationships. Yeah, that was one of my favourites. It was so pretty and bubblegum pop and just such a lovely romantic story whilst not neglecting any of the real issues that are going on in Kenya.
Sounds like that was a fruitful 5 days.
It was. It was exhausting.
Seen more films than I saw in a month.
Yeah, but I came back absolutely pumped. It was fantastic. Oh, also, obviously, Widows. Stephen Queen's new film.
About that, the opener of the London Film Festival.
Good. So good.
We'll talk about that on the podcast in early November. I can't wait for that. Whilst you were away, Karina, loads of films were playing in Picture House cinemas across the country, and cinemas are definitely getting busier as the weather is getting colder. But as we liked it on the Picture House podcast, Toby, as we look at the top five films at Picture House cinemas last weekend, do you care to hazard a guess at what might have been in the top five this weekend just gone?
Interesting. How did The Little Stranger do?
That's a good solid guess. Karina, what do you think will be in the top five?
Is Black Klansman still hanging in there?
Black Klansman, also a great guess. I'm going to take both of those from you two, and I'll tell you the answers. Number five, it's The King of Thieves, directed by James Marsh, a film that I didn't particularly like, but lots of customers clearly do because it's made it into the top five. I described the film as clunky. Number four is The Little Stranger, the new film from Lenny Abrahamson, the director of Room, starring Donald Gleeson and Ruth Wilson. And it looks pretty good. I haven't seen it myself, but yeah, that went in at number four in week one. So yeah, interesting. Probably not as big an audience as maybe we'd hope for a film in week one. Because in number three, it is Black Klansman, which has hung around now for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's doing so well at Picture House. And like, it's good for Spike Lee in general, good across the country. But I think the fact that it's still in the Picture House top five at number three, ahead of films that have come out later than it, really shows that Picture House customers are coming out to support this movie.
Has it fallen out of the top five, or has it been consistently in the top five?
Consistently in the top five. Nice. I mean, we reviewed it on this podcast, and I think everybody was quite positive about the film. I really, really loved it. But I think this has got the word of mouth, that sweet spot that distributors look for.
Yeah.
You know, word of mouth. And the fact that Like, this is just...
My mum finally watched it and she shouted down the street at me. She's just like, you didn't tell me that Harry Belafonte was in it. I was like, what? She's just like, that was the key thing. You should have told me that ages ago. I would have watched it weeks ago. So, yeah, my mum's seal of approval, if that's important to you, is there. Big thumbs up.
Well, listeners, in case you didn't realise, Harry Belafonte is in the film and Karina's mum gives it a thumbs up. Number two, it's also a film that came out last week, Crazy Rich Asians.
Of course.
Which I loved.
Yes, it's brilliant. It's very romantic. It's very weepy. I found myself actually tearing up, you know, the crescendo scene. It was very beautiful and funny.
Yeah, it's being sold as a rom-com. I think it's more rom-drama with a bit of com in it. Like, it's quite silly, but yeah. I didn't laugh out loud. It was like the film was sort of made of marshmallows almost.
Yeah.
It was a nice place to be if you like marshmallows. And I enjoyed being there, but I'm normally a big laugher in films, and I maybe chuckled out loud a few times.
Yeah, there was a couple of slapdash moments where people just fall over and you're just like, ha, that's quite funny.
Falling over is
Yeah, falling
funny,
over is always funny. But it actually also presses on some interesting topics within the dynamics of relationships when it comes to wealth and stature, which I thought was very interesting.
I really was invested in the characters. And I know some people have said that, especially the male character, the male lead in the film is quite weak, but I really cared about their relationship, cared about the family.
He's so beautiful, though, so that's all you need sometimes.
He's so pretty. Very pretty, man.
He's so pretty.
So that's a thumbs up for Crazy Rich Asians,
yes,
if you
definitely.
Like watching very rich people on screen, or just pretty people on
and
screen.
And the food scenes make
food
me very
good,
hungry.
Yeah. They eat too much food. There's a street food scene in the film, right?
Yeah.
They order pretty much every single piece of street food between four people. I was thinking you're going to waste it, but then they
I
are crazy
that
rich.
Too.
I just like to see that movie. You're just going down like a street feast kind of thing. You know, you have to spend like 10 minutes with each one.
Like Chef, that Jon Favreau movie.
Yeah, but better.
Yeah,
better.
Chef was terrible.
And in at number one, it's a new entry. It's A Simple Favour, a new Paul Feig film starring Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick. Also with Henry Golding from Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, see, this is what I was going to see if Crazy Rich Asians was sold out, and it wasn't.
So
I got that last seat, so this is what I'm going to try and catch this weekend for sure.
I hear really, really good things about this.
Me
I love
too.
Paul Feig. I really like The Heat. I really like Spy. I really like Bridesmaids. This doesn't seem to be as out and out a comedy, or at least in the marketing. I hear actually when you see the film, it's quite funny.
I heard him say he's channeling Hitchcock.
Okay.
Which is cool. Okay. I didn't get that from anything I've seen of the movie. I've not seen the movie yet, but I thought that was quite interesting, using Hitchcock as a reference for a guy you associate with kind of laugh out loud comedies. And Hitchcock's got humour in it, but he's more known as suspense and drama.
There's that sense of cuttingness that I'm getting from the marketing vibes.
It's quite an angular campaign.
Yeah,
there's
there
some
you go.
Straight lines and triangles.
A lot of corners to cut.
Tight cut dresses.
It's like a suburban, like, it's set in suburbia, but also like people are saying it's quite a dark comedy / thriller, and I guess that Hitchcock sort of uses that domestic space.
Yeah.
I thought it looked a little bit like Thoroughbreds, which I really liked.
Yes, the pristine white living rooms and the big house and things.
But the word of mouth for A Simple Favour has definitely intrigued me, and I've got a little WhatsApp group with all my cinephile girlfriends, and I was like, girls, is this actually any good? And the general consensus was thumbs up, so
oh, I love that you can call on this hive mind of like,
oh yes,
guys, what's going on?
yes.
So that's the top five. They're all still playing in cinema, so if we've intrigued you listeners, do go and check them out whilst you can. I would make a beeline for BlacKkKlansman, because whilst it has done amazingly well at holding on, more and more films are being released, and I think it will eventually be pushed out of cinemas kicking and screaming, maybe, by the sounds of things.
Its weeks are numbered.
So there's a whole load of new films coming out at the end of September and the first couple of weeks of October. And on this podcast, we're going to talk about The Wife, we're going to talk about Blind Spotting, we're going to talk about A Star Is Born, and we're going to talk about First Man, in that order. Shall we kick off with the new Glenn Close film, co-starring Jonathan Pryce and Christian Slater, called The Wife?
It's a very great film, based on the Meg Wolitzer novel from, I think, about 10 years ago. The story revolves around an author called Joe Castleman, who's played by Jonathan Pryce, and his wife, Joan, played by Glenn Close. And when the film starts, we learn that Joe has just been summoned to receive the Nobel Prize of Literature, which is a big deal for authors and writers. And so that's where the film starts, and they fly over to Stockholm with their adult son, David, to collect the prize. On the plane, we're introduced to Christian Slater's character, who is a different kind of writer who's trying to write a book about Joe and his career, but he has some inside knowledge on some potential secrets around Joe and his career that also affect Joan. How these secrets start to unfold in the coming days, just as Joe's about to receive this prestigious prize, is where the drama of the film lies. And if I say too much more, I will be spoiling it.
That's a great synopsis without giving anything away. Because yeah, I find it quite difficult to explain it without dropping some clangers. But no, it's good.
You'll get no clangers out of me.
One thing that you missed out is the very, very, very beginning of the film. You see the two loving couple in bed together, which is very rare.
What, like a 70-year-old couple?
Yeah. And I thought it was very refreshing.
I didn't want to spoil that bit.
Well, I mean, considering it's literally in the first 5 seconds.
No, it's actually quite a bold opening that you wouldn't expect. Like, it's a quiet scene, but it's not a scene that you see on screen very much. So yeah, it's quite an interesting opening, and it really sets up the character dynamics between the two of them. And in fact, in the first 10-15 minutes of the film, you see all the various roles Glenn Close has in this relationship, you know, and how she sort of is with her husband and takes on different roles depending on what sort of mood he's in or what he needs.
And not just the roles within her overall lifestyle, her as a mother, her as this long-serving person in a very long relationship, which has had its ups and downs.
Serving seems to be the word. Throughout the film, we kind of realise she sacrificed a lot to support him, and that's kind of an undercurrent and theme of the film and how she deals with that. And also it's about how she kind of owns that, but is also sick of it.
Yeah, because you don't always get the sense that she's hardened by that or she's upset by being a servant, if you like, because there's an element within the trajectory of that overall relationship where she genuinely wants to do that, and she genuinely feels that she should do that. But then, I guess, as wisdom packs on, you start looking back and going, was I doing that for me, or was I doing that for someone else? Which I think is so interesting about the film. It makes you think about the dynamics of long-term relationships.
Yeah, definitely. I think that long-term relationship is kind of the key of the film because it is kind of driving everything that she's doing. And she's very subtle in her performance. But you can, and this is, you know, one of the strengths of the film is Glenn Close and her performance. You can see in her face
she's incredible.
40, 50 years of being in a relationship and the sort of toll that's taken. And again, it's not all negative, but it's just you've got that wisdom in her face and those stories. And she conveys a lot without... I mean, the film does reach a climactic moment between the two main characters, but it's the subtleties where the strengths are and the way it builds. And it's a great scene between her and Christian Slater as well, about halfway through the film. And the chemistry between those two is just incredible.
Yeah, Christian Slater's been so good.
Yeah, it's great to see him kind of... I mean, he's more of a TV actor now, I guess, with... Is it Mr. Robot?
He's
is that
Mr.
his
Robot,
show?
Yeah. He's also done lots of straight-to-DVD films. He hasn't done, I guess, If the Wife is a Prestige Picture. It's in contention for Oscars for Glenn Close's performance.
If you look at the Metro today, they're talking about her Oscar prospects.
Because she's been nominated so many times. And
six
never
times.
Won. Six times and never won. This is Glenn Close, guys. How can you not give Glenn Close an Oscar?
Just give it to her.
It's her time.
I think the prestige of all of the actors together is quite a treat in this film. They're all actors who, as well as doing films and TV shows, they do lots of theatre work. And there is that old adage of, like, you know, theatre actors are the most actory of actors. They're the best kind. But I think actually when you put three actors who you know have lots of stage experience together in quite close sets sometimes with lots of dialogue, they really play off each other, and it's so much fun to watch.
You can see that in the film, and the director Björn Runge, who's a Swedish filmmaker, he filmed it in a very specific style where it's quite brightly lit, and the camera work is, at first instance, you could say it's kind of basic and a bit formulaic, but actually what he's doing is he's really just pulling the camera back and letting the actors do their job. And that is an incredible thing for a director to do nowadays, because there's so many things that directors like to do with cameras and edits and lighting. There's very little of that in The Wife. It's done in always just pull it back and let these great actors do their work, and you can see their faces and the scenes play out for as long as they need to. And it's definitely an actor's movie, and that's not to take away from the filmmaking, because the filmmaking was constructed in a way to allow the acting to come to the forefront. It's really interesting to see that kind of approach work. And
it's the trust that he's given his actors. He knows he's casted well.
Yeah, you've got Jonathan Pryce and Glenn Close. Let them do what they do, and they've got amazing sizzle on screen. So,
and Glenn Close is acting with her daughter.
Well, sort of. Yeah, so in the flashback scenes, the younger Joan is played by Glenn Close's daughter, Annie Stark. So they don't have any on-screen time together. That's a nice little...
That's cosy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's such a smart
acting
thing to do. Like, if your actor daughter is also... She's the right age to play a younger version of your character. Like, why not?
Yeah.
And actually, looking at Annie Stark's CV, she's done this a number of times, playing a younger Glenn Close or playing Glenn Close's real-life daughter in films. It's like a lot of her career is playing alongside or in films with her mum.
I mean, I guess if your mum's Glenn Close, then you kind of accept that you're going to be in her shadow. That'll be fine, you know.
What I really liked about this film is I thought it looked looked so beautiful and it was so nice to be in Stockholm. And then I found out I wasn't in Stockholm. I was in Glasgow.
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
Glasgow now doubles up for early 90s Stockholm. Who'd have thunk it? The magic of cinema. So yeah, I think that's a big thumbs up for the wife.
Yes. Yeah. It's,
we were lucky enough to talk to actual real life Glenn Close. Like Glenn flipping Close on the podcast. There's a special interview episode online right now when Glenn Close came over for the UK premiere of The Wife at Somerset House, which was a beautiful outdoor screening of the film in August. So of course it rained, but everybody still stayed and had a jolly time.
Well, I think that's a testament to the film. It was a beautiful evening. Well, it was a horrible afternoon, a beautiful evening, and then just before the film started, it chucked it down with rain. And to be fair, nearly everyone stayed.
Yeah. People were very well prepared. There were lots of anoraks and
I was very impressed.
I loved watching that whole courtyard full of the biggest cinema fans you could probably find in London right there and then in their waterproofs watching Glenn Close, watching The Wife and just sticking it out and going, nope, I'm going to enjoy this, damn it.
Invested.
Yeah, it was great.
So there's no excuse for not sitting in a plushy cinema.
This is true.
A picture house cinema with good upholstery and legroom.
Yeah.
Hopefully you're not being rained on.
No, that's true.
So, you know, if you can sit through it on the cobbles at Somerset House in the pouring rain.
Well, The Wife is out now, so you can be that ideal that Toby has just regaled us with. You can be in the cinema, not listening to this podcast, hopefully. Turn this off, watch the film, turn it back on, carry on listening, and we'll talk about some other films. So on that, let's talk about a film that comes out in early October, on 5th of October, Blindspotting. A Sundance hit, I think it's fair to say, and it's done a few festivals around the way, and it's now finally coming out in UK cinemas. Karina, you watched this last night?
I watched it last night, finally. You don't understand, I've been trying to watch this film all year. All year. I went to Sundance, Utah, I missed it on the opening night because so many people were so keen to go and see it that literally the whole of Utah and film fanatics went and we were like 1,000th in the queue, so that wasn't going to happen. So I saw it last night, finally, and it's great. It's got David Diggs from Hamilton fame, and he's been actually working on this for about 10 years, which is quite surprising, and he's written it and he's starring in it, and he's also working alongside Raphael Cassell, and they are real-life best buds. It's set in Oakland, California, and the premise is that we start off with the best friend driving a removal truck van as their day job, but Raphael has 3 days left of his probation, so we are on this journey to make sure that he gets through those last 3 days without being thrown back in the slammer. He's on probation for an unfortunate fight whilst he was on a job as a bouncer. During that 3 days, he actually comes across a police shooting, so then he's set with this issue of, does he go and tell the police? But considering that he's a young black man on probation, are they going to believe him? No, they're not. So that's the premise, but there's so much more packed into it in terms of how we have our unconscious biases, the issues between Raphael and his friend, basically a black and a white guy, and how they navigate their relationships around their race. Gentrification is a massive issue within this film as well, because you have the new people coming in that are generally white, techie startup guys, and it's pushing out the older black community. There's some musical elements in here as well. Mm-hmm. There's some poetry elements in here. There's a lot of comedy, a lot of humour, but ultimately there's a lot of social commentary about what's going on right now in America, and it's grasped in a very real, genuine, artistic and accessible way. And it feels like a very important film right now, especially within the fabric of films where we've got Get Out, Sorry to Bother You coming out, Black Klansman. The time is now for this kind of movie to be watched, observed and heeded.
What's nice about this film is it's one of those like classic film festival films that rides the wave of acclaim and commentary at film festivals, and hopefully it has built to a fan base waiting for it in cinemas. It's like the old, it's quite old school. It feels like what 90s indie films did.
I mean, I've not seen the film, but I've seen the trailer and poster this week, and what you said about it being a kind of 90s movie, I kind of got, because it kind of, like, the trailer kind of hooked me in, but then I got quite confused halfway through the trailer about what the film actually is. And then the poster made it look more mainstream than I was expecting. So yeah, I'm kind of really intrigued to actually see it for myself and kind of work out what the vibe of it is. Because I couldn't tell if it was kind of comedy, if it was drama, if it was like one of those kind of social message movies.
But it's all of those things packed in very, very well. I've seen Sorry to Bother You, which is also very good, but it's a lot. There's a lot going on in there, and it doesn't always land as poetically, if you like. Because of the 3 day period as well, you have this tension building, like, is he going to make it? Is he going to make it? It will work on so many different levels in terms of different audiences, because this is very true to the experience of a young black man in America and the issues that face the young people within these areas. And it's just such a normal part of life that they have to teach the kids that the police are a threat to them. Like, this is what happens when, not if, when the police stop you. So it's done in a very realistic way, but it isn't done in a very message kind of way. Mm-hmm. It's just done very factually demonstrating that this is an experience that we're having to grapple with. Again, just a lot of the unconscious biases about gentrification and what that actually means and the pros and cons. And it's not conclusive on whether gentrification is good or bad, because ultimately they always come with good and bad elements. But it is showing that gentrification, when you have it and it's not serving those that originated from that area, that it shows the negativity of that. Blindspotting, for what the title means, is essentially, you see this point where she's looking at the Rubin's vase. It's about how one vision can have two different representations. Ultimately, if you need to look at something hard in order to see the issues of it, that's work. It's really well done in the way it's looking at that.
I thought it was called blindspotting because in the trailer, he sees the shooting happen in his rearview mirror, and I thought it happened in his blind spot.
There is that as well.
So he couldn't.
There is that as well.
So,
for sure.
So I thought that, because that bit's in the trailer. So, like, he sees the shooting and the cop's like by his window. And I thought it was going to be like, but what did you see? Because it was in your blind spot. But I think your explanation of the title is a bit.
Yeah, maybe the title is a Rubin's vase of.
Yeah. Could mean all sorts.
I thought this film juggled the tone really well. It also it knows that the audience are watching this as a piece of escapism, and it is fun to watch. And
yeah,
you do laugh
funny.
Out loud, and it's remarkable. There's some scenes where you're so tense and some scenes where you're belly laughing. There's some really good inserts throughout the film, and it gets on the characters' nerves that the area is being gentrified because they're true boys from Oakland. Mm. And occasionally they'll cut in like a hipster on a unicycle or something. And I'd love that stuff. As they're driving around, they'll see, you know, loads of like coffee shops serving flat whites, and they'll see guy on a unicycle or whatever. And it's just like this like little, they don't have any lines. It's just inserts can be used as punctuation to also just remind us how ridiculous this whole thing is. He buys these $10 aloe vera drinks throughout the film, and he gets made fun of at the beginning, and then they're like, oh, actually they're really good for you.
Yeah. But you can buy that in the same shop where his friend is buying a cigarette for $1. So it's how these old school and new school elements of an area rubbing up against each other. And also, anybody that's seen Hamilton, which is a lot of people by now, I think you really will enjoy that, because you've got that element of performance poetry in there as well, which might actually put a lot of people off, but don't let it, because it's really interesting use of language, and they call it heightened verse, which is a like hybrid between performance narrative and poetry and spoken word and rapping. But it was used really well towards the end of the film, which went spoil.
Yeah, I love this film, and I think this film does need word of mouth, and it does need people to talk about it. It's out on the 5th of October. I really loved it. Proper old school indie film about very contemporary issues, and yeah, it's got that guy from Hamilton in. He's so good. On a musical note, shall we talk about A Star Is Born, the new Bradley Cooper film, directed by Bradley Cooper, produced by Bradley Cooper, also co-starring Lady Gaga and Sam Elliott. For listeners who, and I don't know if you guys are really familiar with the journey of A Star Is Born, I've recently become obsessed with old school musicals. The first version of this film was in 1937, and it was about a vaudeville star going into cinema, and that was the journey of the star. And then it was remade with Judy Garland in the 50s. After Judy Garland sort of famously crashed out of Hollywood, she had 3 years of going on the road, touring Europe, playing in music halls, becoming the Judy Garland singer that a lot of us are aware of. And then she came back to Hollywood, and this was her first film, and it is about this tragic star. And it was quite a good, very relevant story to Judy Garland as an actor, as well as her on-screen character. And then in the 70s, it was remade with Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson, and they moved it away from cinema and becoming an actor to becoming a music star. And this version we get now is closer to the Kris Kristofferson, Barbara Streisand version, about the journey from unknown singer to a big music hero. And yeah, it's an interesting one. This is Bradley Cooper's directorial debut. Normally when you make your directorial debut, it's a little one that just sort of trickles out in festivals. This is a huge Oscar-baiting, giant campaign, and he's cast arguably one of the biggest pop stars in the world in the singing role. Very smart move. But Bradley Cooper's character is also supposed to be a very successful singer. And at the beginning of the film, he is the professional singer and she is the waitress who's going to go on to become a singer. And he put his time in. He did 18 months of singing lessons. He plays guitar. In the film, they have real footage shot at Glastonbury Festival, a bunch of real festivals where they're on stage singing to a real crowd. So he's not faking it. Like, he had to learn to sing.
That was recorded in Glastonbury Festival?
Some of it was, yeah. And other real life festivals.
So how did that... I can imagine just being a Glastonbury and just suddenly seeing on the lineup, and now Bradley Cooper.
Well, I heard from a friend who, so it wasn't this year's, the 2018, it was the 2017 edition where they apparently did the Glastonbury filming. And they've made such a fuss about this in the press, but it's actually like a 30 seconds of the film. It's tiny. Okay. But someone who was there was, it was just one of those word of mouth things. You know, at Glastonbury, people do like secret shows and things. It's like, apparently Bradley Cooper's on stage in the field down there.
Yeah, you'd be like, how many ciders have I had?
So it was just like one of those things that on the day he came on, did a set, Lady Gaga was there as well. And, you know, it's Glastonbury, so you've probably seen weirder things in the field, I guess.
I've definitely seen worse. I missed this, and I was really upset. I missed this at TIFF, but everybody that was coming out of the press screenings and all the public screenings loved it. Did you enjoy it? You love a musical.
Yeah, I love musicals. I really, really love those MGM musicals where, you know, like it's quite false and the sets pull away and everybody bursts into song. This isn't that. This is a musical about people who are singers. So when they sing, it's actually in the diegesis of the film. They are singing a song because this song will get them the record deal or whatever. What really struck me is the songs are actually really good. I think a lot of them were written before the film by Lady Gaga, and I think she has the eventual tie-in album due to come out.
Yeah. So who wrote the bulk of the songs? They were her songs.
Gaga Productions. I don't really know too much about Lady Gaga apart from the big, big, big hits. But at the beginning of the film especially, she is singing country songs and old school, like very American, gruff country songs. And then it sort of changes. Sort of she goes on this journey of stardom and has to sort of change her image to become an even bigger star. And then she starts doing electronic and pop stuff, which we might be a bit more familiar with her doing. Mm. And I was really struck by, like, Gaga's good. I know Gaga can sing. I was struck by how good Bradley Cooper can sing and how good his performance is. He's really channeling that like Crazy Heart vibe of like he's a gruff, bearded, alcoholic like star, and he's been around the track a few times. I thought I would be most impressed by her because I've never really seen Lady Gaga act on this level.
Can she act?
She can act really well. She's done a few roles in like American Horror Story, and lots of people are saying this is Lady Gaga's feature debut. It's like, no, guys, she was in Sin City 2. Obviously, come on. I always thought Bradley Cooper was pretty good. You know, I wasn't so big on like Silver Linings Playbook or that sort of stuff, but in this, it's like a whole other side of Bradley Cooper. He's transformed. So Todd Phillips, who directed the Hangover films, has a producer credit on this, and it reminded me that the Hangover films exist and how Bradley Cooper is like very clean-shaven, very slick in those films. And in this, he's like a lumbering Hulk.
This is interesting because I've only really caught onto the narrative that this is Lady Gaga and her song and her story, but actually it's Bradley Cooper's.
The thing that runs through all of the Star is Born cinematic universe is that it's about these people who love each other so madly, and one of them at the beginning of the film is very successful, one of them is unknown of, and they sort of switch in the narrative of the film, and that's like the only through line. And the whole thing is like, you know, this relationship might not be great for me, but we love each other so much. And it's both of them, really. It's better when they're both on screen. When it's just one of them on screen, I feel like the film comes off the boil a bit.
So they have chemistry.
Really good chemistry. Like, mind-blowing chemistry. I think technically this film is really good. I think if you've seen any of the other versions, they haven't dramatically rewritten this story. It's almost become like a Shakespeare play of these things always happen in A Star is Born. So if you've seen the Judy Garland version, which is very good, if you've seen the Chris Christopherson version, also very good, you'll probably know what's coming and it might take out some of the drama. If you've never seen one of those before, don't watch those on Blu-ray. Watch this one first in the cinema, and then maybe for research you can investigate the older ones. But yeah, it's very well directed, very well shot. Beautifully performed. Sam Elliott is a performing actor in this. He plays Bradley Cooper's brother, which is kind of weird casting, but Bradley Cooper looks so haggard and grizzled. Actually, Sam Elliott's quite good.
I'm quite looking forward to seeing Bradley Cooper more like that, because I think that was kind of part of his appeal waning, looking a little bit too polished and a bit like your uncle.
Yeah, no, I think this is him showing a different side of Bradley. I really enjoyed this and I really want to own the soundtrack album.
Of course
you
do.
If that could come out now, please, that would be good. I will, as I have done with Mamma Mia and The Greatest Showman, I will probably buy it on some sort of record.
Of course you will.
And show everybody in the office. So you can look forward to that. Finally, shall we talk about First Man, the new Chazelle film, which premiered at the Venice Film Festival and was at Toronto Film Festival, like a lot of films coming out right now. This stars Ryan Gosling, who he previously worked with in La La Land together, and we've got Claire Foy and Jason Clarke and a whole bunch of people who you're like, it's that guy. Very recognisable American film actors in this movie. This is a dramatisation of the early days of space travel leading up to Neil Armstrong going to the moon and all of the sort of drama that happens behind the scenes.
We just also need to mention Kyle Chandler, who's like one of the guys in charge of the whole operation. He is the best character actor out there. I will go and see any film with Kyle Chandler in. He crops up about two or three films a year, nails it.
And he's an actor, isn't he? Yeah, he's an actor. He's
if
not a
he's
star,
in a film,
he's an actor.
The film's going to be good. He played the brother in Manchester by the Sea for perspective, but he's in so many films. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
So this film gave me real Apollo 13 vibes, which is high praise indeed, because that's one of my favourite films.
Apollo 13 is one of the greats. This one's quite different, I feel. It kind of flirts between Apollo 13 and Interstellar.
Yeah, I see that.
Somewhere between the two in terms of tone and vibe, which is quite interesting. You'd think the temptation would be to do a remake of Apollo 13, effectively, but about the Apollo 11 mission. And this isn't that. It's a very different kind of movie. You know, it's based over about 10 years, isn't it? It's like 10 years of Neil Armstrong's life, from being hired to be an astronaut to walking on the moon, which is about a 10-year
period. There's
lots
of scenes in like classrooms and offices and stuff, because it is the early days where actually just the concept of doing some of the basic things like being in a rocket and going through takeoff has not really been explored. And there's lots of rehearsals of what it is like, to be in that sort of environment and getting everything just right for the astronauts. There's a really great scene in a spinny cage, don't know what the science word is, but which is supposed to simulate, you know, being weightless.
Yeah, it's kind of stressful.
The camera's like strapped to the thing. It's so, it made me feel a bit sick in
Ryan Gosling pulls some faces in that. I don't know if he really was going through it. If he wasn't, that was some great face acting.
Well, he's got a good face.
Yeah, he does have a good not face. So much in that scene, but
what did you think, Karina?
I was lucky enough to see it at TIFF, and Ryan Gosling was there in his suit and Claire Foy, and you know, the whole drama of watching it in a big beautiful auditorium added to the enjoyment of it. However, I did find myself a little bored. I'd only realized afterwards that that's kind of the point. Like, Neil Armstrong is actually a really boring man, and he's very systematic, and he's basically been bred to be a robot, because that's what, if you're going to be an astronaut, you do have to have that kind of tendency to just be very, very precise and a
efficient.
Little bit and efficient, yeah, absolutely,
and practical,
all the things that generally don't add to
that aren't that human,
add to a kind of guy that is a barrel of laughs. I thought it was saying a lot about America and that time when America was presenting itself as big and powerful and had the ability and the privilege to go to the moon, and what that meant for the communities that were left behind whilst all this money was being pumped into this massive space mission. And I think the female representation in it is very interesting, because it as much as, you know, it barely passes the Bechdel test, or there's much female representation in it, I think that's kind of the point. And the same with the minority representation, because it's so interesting that it's got the Gil Scott-Heron song Whitey on the Moon in there. And I think that's just a very subtle reminder to the social issues that were going on at that time. Technically, it's gorgeous and brilliant, and my breath was taken away by the music of it. And Damien Chazelle's got a very good grasp on tension building via music, obviously, what with Whiplash being incredible, and La La Land having that musical stream for it. And yeah, I think it's a good old-fashioned blockbuster movie that does definitely need to be seen in the cinema, and it's patriotic to one extent, but also looking at America for what it is and what it's achieved and what it has done for toxic masculinity on that thread, it's also an interesting way to observe it.
I think hindsight is quite interesting in this film, because it's obviously set in the 60s as it's a period piece, but as an audience member, you're like, they're talking about how space travel is going to change the world, and we watching it in 2018 are like, that didn't happen. And then they're talking about the cost of human lives and the cost of just money, and you're sort of like, is that actually responsible in this day and age? And so it is interesting watching it through that sort of glass as a window into the past.
This is it. It was an irresponsible mission, but for the self-esteem of America, they were like, no, we're going to do this.
It was like a global sort of willy-waving competition, wasn't
it?
Oh,
for sure.
We're better than Russia.
And I just love when Claire Foy basically just shouts at them, going, you're just a bunch of boys that don't know what they're doing. And it's like, that's exactly it.
And I guess the other side of that is, to defend the rich white guys, it's kind of this idea of going to the moon, it was ultimately the Cold War, hitting climax, that's what it was. But it's, and this is referenced in the film as well, the inspiration of people to do this. Not to be too corny, but they reference the Kennedy speech, we don't do it because it's easy, we do it because it's hard.
Yeah.
You can read that however you want to read it.
Yeah.
It's also like, why did people get on a boat and travel to America in the first place? You know, the idea of exploration is quite a romantic idea, an essential one for human progression.
Absolutely,
be that literally or mentally. So it's quite interesting that these astronauts who are doing this dangerous adventure aren't romantic people. You know, and that's the real core element of this film. Because the film is actually more about Neil Armstrong's relationship with his wife and kids, and how detached he is from them. And whether that's because that's what men were like at the time, but especially what men like him were like at the time, kind of military scientists with this one goal and mission. The point of the film is, arguably, he can't communicate with the humans in his life, but he can go to the moon. So is
that's it?
It's this sacrifice and payoff of being like, I give up on my beautiful wife and kids and do this amazing thing for the world to see. But ultimately, I don't care if the world sees it because I'm a very private man anyway. So just this kind of duality of his character, where clearly he's fascinated by adventure and sees the higher reasoning for going. There's a scene in the film where after some of the astronauts have died on test missions, and one of the guys goes, at what point are we going to pull the plug, at what cost? And Neil Armstrong's response is, and it's the only time he really gets angry in the film, he says, we've already gone past that point. People have already died, so we have to keep going. I think he's a very complex character that you don't see enough of in film because he doesn't emote much.
It's all very internal.
Yeah, very internal. And Gosling's very good at doing that. He's actually quite a good face actor, partly because he has a lovely face, but he can convey a lot with these kind of silent characters. And I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting elements to that. Arguably, though, I'm kind of interested to why this film has sort of come out now, because it doesn't feel like a particularly trendy movie. You know, it's not the anniversary of the moon landing, from what I can tell. There's not that much for people to latch onto, don't you know? America and patriotism aren't popular things right now. You know, people don't like America very much. And actually, one thing about this film, I didn't find it particularly flag-waving. Like, there was actually a story that broke that the film's already been criticised by some people in America because you don't see them plant the flag.
Yes.
You do see the flag in frame at one point, but you don't actually have the scene where they plant the flag. I don't know. I know Gosling and Chazelle did comment on this to say why they didn't. I'm not sure what their reason was. But it's
Gosling's Canadian.
Yes, he doesn't care.
It's quite an interesting one to break down. And I remember after we saw it, we had quite a long chat. My cinema goers and I on the way home on the tube, just sort of like, and one more thing.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about with it.
But you don't realise it until afterwards.
Absolutely.
It's actually quite
it's a dry movie.
Dry, cold movie.
Technically amazing.
Yeah.
You know, there's some beautiful scenes. And like, this would be a spoiler if I go on about it too much, but they filmed the surface of the moon in two different ways, which is really interesting. There's before they land on it and once they've landed on it, the how you're looking at the moon in terms of film stock is different. And I thought it was, you know, and fair play to Damien Chazelle, this film is visually so different to La La Land. It's him and the same DP, but it's grainy, it's handheld, whereas La La Land is kind of bright, crisp, pristine, and like, you know, all the shots are organised. This is much more kind of all over the place, really. I mean, it's still thought out, but the visual style is very different. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting to see how his career's developing, really, as a filmmaker.
Well, there we go. That's four absolute belters to go and see at the cinema in the next couple of weeks.
They time up pretty well. You got The Wife first, then you can do a Blind Spotting Star Is Born double bill, and then have a First Man dessert the week after.
Sounds like a really
delicious
meal.
Like 3 weeks of good eating at the cinema.
Thank you so much, Toby, for being guest on the podcast this week.
Thanks for
having me. Thank you, Karina, for returning. Still jealous of Toronto. I'm going to blag the Toronto trip next year. And a huge thank you to Silk Factory, proud supporters of the Picture House podcast. Silk Factory are an awesome film marketing creative agency. We're sat in them right now and it's beautiful. They make the coolest trailers and creative content out there across TV, digital and social platforms. We think they're great. We record the podcast here. They're super, super nice. We love their fantastic work and you can check it out at www.thesilkfactory.co. Thank you, listeners, for listening, and please do rate, review, subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. Love those star ratings. Give us a little 5-star. All you have to do, just one tap, 5 stars. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks.